interesting question. It could also be the beginning of something new. And as we are seeing here, this was a period of the creation of new ideas. We may be going into another enlightenment. I mean, that's maybe overly optimistic, but in some real sense, we are in a new age with technology changing the way we live in many, many ways. Economically, people are much better off than they were last century. So you would expect essentially a intellectual revolution or a social revolution and an enlightenment, so to speak, perhaps of a similar scale if you compare the printing press to the invention of the internet. I want to remind your listeners that you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. You can find archives of our show at tcps.podbean.com. We've recently moved there, and so far I am very much enjoying the service. There is also an app you can download, I believe, on the Google Play Store and also on iOS. So, this is the third episode on a series on progress that really wants to get to the roots of why we hold progress to be such an important idea as people, especially as Canadians. I know that specifically in my case as a Canadian, the idea of progress is just something that I essentially grew up on. It's part of my textbooks, my academic experience, the books that I read. Everything talks about how human beings need to move in the direction of progress. You hear phrases like, you know, we want to be on the right side of history, or phrases like this is progress or this is the future. And so just growing up with all of those statements swirling around, it's like the idea of progress, that we're going somewhere that's going to be better in some way, or at least different, and that things are changing. And whether that change is progress or is not progress has been something that, I don't know, I've been steeped in my entire life. So seeing where those ideas and theories that have dealt with those ideas come from has been an interesting experience.
I would like to, if it's okay, Aaron, to bring a case in point, which is completely contemporary, like in the last few weeks.
Okay.
And
sure.
So I going hope this is somehow relevant. Yeah. I hope I'm going to go up on a tangent, but I think it's a tangent that's relevant. And I always like to take our, you know, theory, our abstract theories and really, and you know, long ago histories and try and like really bring it home to what this stuff means right now in our daily lives. So I'm taking a different trajectory than what I have so far today. I'm not arguing like, you know, metaphysics of progress and that kind of stuff. I'm talking about progress in our society. So right here in British Columbia today. So I am spending most of my time in Vancouver, and I'm a cyclist. So there's a very popular road that goes through Stanley Park in Vancouver called Stanley Park Road, and it's heavily used by tourists and locals for recreation, cyclists, automobiles, families with strollers, people walking, people on scooters, all kinds of things. And what happened during COVID was there was this huge increase in the amount of people using the park, and especially of people that were cycling. So the city government that was in power at the time during the COVID pandemic decided to take one of the two car lanes, and in many places in the park, turn that into a dedicated bicycle lane in order to make it more attractive for cyclists and to protect cyclists, decrease the danger of collisions, you know, by competition between cyclists and automobiles on the same road. And it just became this really popular biking, walking, strolling lane. But it did at times slow down the automobile traffic, which was restricted to one lane. And sometimes it would get very slow, and other times it would be moving along. You know, it just wouldn't allow people to pass and go faster. So anyway, one might say that this is progress. This was progress. It was looking forward to a moving away from the dominance of automobiles to more of a multifaceted recreational environment, with automobiles not dominating, but having to share resources, share the road with people doing other things, on scooters, on bicycles, kids, walkers, all kinds of people. So one might say that that progress is being made as our little society here in Vancouver is now looking forward to a new paradigm where automobiles are more less important. They're not, everything's not centered around automobiles for a lot of different reasons. One being there's all these new recreational opportunities with all the new, you know, with scooters and new kind of bicycles, gravel bikes and everything like that. And the other, because we know now that automobiles pollute and they are a heavy contributor to global warming. So it's a way of looking forward and making progress. And maybe from now on, there should be a dedicated bike lane. But no. So what happened is after the recent municipal election in Vancouver, a party came to power, the ABC party, which really doesn't have much, doesn't value bicycles very much at all. It doesn't have this idea of progress that I've just described. It wants, and they've stated explicitly, the Vancouver Park Board, which is dominated by that party also, not just the city council, but the park board, the ABC party, has the members have explicitly stated that they want to go back to the way things were before COVID. They have just recently voted just a few days ago to eliminate the temporary bike lane, to go back to the way things were before COVID. And with some kind of vague promise that in the future in another year or more, they'll revisit the idea of maybe having a dedicated bike lane. But for the time being, they've stated, we want to go back to the way things were. So that's just a local example of perhaps to answer the question of what does progress mean versus conservatism, right? What is progressivism versus conservatism? So if we use the progressive form of the word progress, derivative of the word progress, we could say that, or we could argue, right? We could argue that progress might mean looking forward, making changes to better the world, to better people's lives, to take into account the new information that we have, to take into account the new scientific information we have about global warming and the effect of the burning of fossil fuels and the internal combustion engine, looking forward, making progress, versus the counter to progress, which is conservatism, the idea of, no, let's go back to the way things were, or let's keep things the way they were and ignore the new information, ignore new values and awarenesses that have been developing.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting example. I would be very tempted to again bring in the line that, you know, this is something that is multifaceted, that you can see from different perspectives, and is potentially complex, because whenever you're dealing with urban planning in a city, there essentially are pros and cons, and whatever you do, some people will be more happy than others or less happy than others. I remember when I was in Vancouver and there was a discussion of whether or not a building should be turned into a science center or an arts center, and that had a vibrant debate on whether or not that building should be a science center or an arts center, and there were different groups sending petitions and arguments about it. The question of which of those changes and which of those directions is progress, is to the greatest benefit of the people living in Vancouver, is an interesting question. It might seem that the Scottish and French Enlightenment have nothing to do with bicycle lanes in Vancouver. I think we might be surprised. So the Scottish and French Enlightenment was roughly contemporaneous and grappled with the same social phenomenon. It is difficult to draw hard and fast contrasts between the two bodies of thought, and better to consider individual authors. So we turn to the writings of David Hume, which are characterized by both naturalism and skepticism. Hume's essays on political questions reflect his general philosophical orientation, although he is less likely than Concordat and Turgot to make sweeping statements about progress. He explores the topic of social development in various interesting ways. In Of the Rise and Progress of the Arts and Sciences, Hume connects political and intellectual development. He begins with the presumption that scientific and artistic progress require a background of political security. From this claim, he argues that the arts and sciences cannot arise in a society without the rule of law. Hume also asserts that no monarchy can develop the rule of law on its own, while republics must develop the rule of law if they are to survive at all. He concludes that the arts and sciences first emerge in republics, not monarchies. Although the arts and sciences have their rise in republics, they can be transplanted into civilized monarchies and continue to improve in that environment. Civilized monarchies are those that have learned the rule of law from neighboring republics. Hume even says that the arts progress more quickly in civilized monarchies than in republics because they are useful for flattering monarchs. On the other hand, according to Hume, the general population is more impressed by scientific discoveries with obvious technological applications than by artistic creations. In other words, people are more impressed by cell phones than statues. Therefore, the sciences progress more quickly in republics in which the general public holds power than in monarchies. And I think that's very interesting. I think it's also somewhat problematic because I think that progress of the art, so to speak, is something that's also very important for human civilization and human society. But I don't want to get distracted, so I'm going to read one more paragraph and finish up Hume. Hume thinks that countries can affect each other's progress. For instance, competition can spur greater progress, and isolation can cause a country to stall. On the other hand, countries can intimidate each other into inactivity. Hume also asserts that the arts and sciences cannot progress indefinitely in a single country. Once they reach a certain height, members of the next generation are too intimidated by their predecessors to strike out on their own. So that is David Hume. He's entered the discussion on progress. And I think, although this isn't entirely analogous, we can bring this last paragraph into your previous example. So if we replace the idea of countries with large cities, which are different things but have some similarities, cities can compete with each other, and that can spur on greater progress, as you were saying. They could compete on being a green city, so to speak, offering wider variety of green spaces and better public transit services. Or they can choose to remain isolated from each other, choose to keep people isolated. And you can see that with vehicles, especially in very large cities, because the larger the city, the more difficult it is to get anywhere with a vehicle. And this is, I wouldn't say it's a universal rule, and I wouldn't say I know what it is, but I would say that from my very limited experience driving in Vancouver and driving in Toronto versus driving in much smaller cities such as Winnipeg or even Montreal and Quebec City, it's you can see that the larger the city is, the harder it is to navigate it by vehicle. And so then the question becomes, well, how do you fix this problem? You can do small things like trying to create more parking, but the problem with creating more parking is that doesn't solve the issue, because now you have more parking in certain areas, but then more vehicles have to come and access that parking, and if vehicles are leaving and going between parking lots frequently, you now have more traffic and more of an argument for traffic. If we were to evaluate this question from Hume's perspective, we would see that cities are competing to right now to see which ones can can be the most green, can provide the best environment for their citizens and their people. What it means to have the best city for your people is, I think, changing in Western countries. In many countries, other countries, such as Japan, for instance, the idea of reliable public services, such as buses and trains, are very important. Also, some countries in Europe. And those have freed much of the general populace from the need to rely on vehicles for transportation. Whereas in Canada and the United States, in most places, you must rely on a vehicle for transportation or face significant upfront costs in time and perhaps convenience to use public transit. I would like your thoughts, Michael, on what he says there about isolation can cause a country to stall. So what you said earlier about the current new government in Vancouver taking out the bike lanes and that perhaps being a problem with the idea of progress, do you think they're isolated in that decision? Or do you think that decision will bring them into someone else's conception of progress? Or do you think that they're isolating Vancouver from a greater set of people with goals?
I think to answer that, I have to delve into politics. Because what I believe is happening is that the business interests, the business stakeholders who lease, I'm not sure if they lease or they own land, probably lease land from the city and run restaurants. So there's some restaurants and some other businesses in Stanley Park. They believe, those businesses believe, that their business is furthered by the free flow of automobiles. So they believe that their business comes mostly from tourists either on tour buses or in automobiles. And rightly or wrongly, correctly or incorrectly, they believe that the restrictions on, or let's say, allocating some of the automobile lanes away from automobiles to cyclists has somehow hurt their businesses, or well in the future hurt their business. I suppose they think that, now I'm, speculating a little bit here. I suppose that those business owners believe that their customer profile is closer to sedentary people in automobiles than it is people who go cycling or running or walking through the park. And I can understand how they might think that, right? Because they want people that eat a lot and drink a lot, and not people that are that just cycle through the park and are fit and healthy and watch what they eat and watch what they drink. My belief is that the politicians now who are in power are in the back pocket of those businesses with regards to planning for Stanley Park, that they know who their donors are. The politicians know, they believe they're banking on support in, political support in future elections and so on from the business interests that have something to gain by more dedicated automobile space, by automobile predominance, the free flow of automobiles, making Stanley Park a great place for automobiles. So I think what we might say here is that in this way, capitalism, the operations of capitalism are actually running counter to progress. So if you accept my assertion that progress would be reducing the importance of automobiles and starting to develop alternative forms of recreation and transportation and move away from automobiles. If we look at that as progress, if you accept that, and maybe you don't, but if one accepts that that's progress, and you might accept that that's progress because it's taken into account science, the science of global warming, the science of medical science, how it's so much more healthful to be active than it is to, sit in a car or sit at a restaurant and drink and eat. Eat high-calorie, fatty food, right? So if we take into account that new information that we've developed, that science has developed over the last number of decades, we might say that progress is de-emphasizing the automobile and putting more incentive and resources into alternative methods of transportation and recreation. And in this case, we're talking about a big recreational area in Vancouver, right? One of the important cities in Canada. So, but the way that capitalism interacts with politics seems to be, at least for the time being, holding back progress. The politicians in Vancouver who are now in power in the ABC party have explicitly stated they want to go back to the way things were. To me, that seems like they are fighting against progress. You did a better job than I did of relating that to Hume and to philosophy, right? But it seems to me there is a, at least if we go into the political realm of political philosophy, there is a relationship, there's a tension, right, between capitalism and progress. In this case, it really shows.
What we're starting to see there is that we have essentially two groups of people with disjoint or distinct interests. You have business owners who see tourism mainly coming from people with vehicles who can visit Stanley Park by vehicle. I'd be interested to know, is Stanley Park connected to any railway, like any train stations? Or is it only connected by buses? So
yeah. There's a little toy train thing, like a little kid's ride.
Yeah.
Well, you could have busloads of people and tourists coming to the perimeter of the park or to certain areas of the park. But if they wanted to go deeper into the park, then they would need to take shuttles. I don't think that the business owners and the people who love to drive their cars through Stanley Park and they like to go fast if they can, you know, many of them, not all of them, some of them go well above the speed limit and they're impeded in doing so if there's only one lane. So I think that they don't like losing a passing lane. So yes, there's a group of people, perhaps a significant group of people that really want to maximize the free flow of automobiles through Stanley Park. But I don't think we can call that progress. This is the point. We can call it keeping things the way they are. That's antithetical to progress, right? Progress suggests moving forward, change, keeping things where they are. Conservatism is not progress. It contradicts progress. And yet when people have something good going, they may not want progress. They may want to keep it that way. So if the business owners were making a lot of money a few years ago, they want to keep it that way. If people that love their automobiles and love driving fast through the park don't want that to change, then they are opposed to progress.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to throw another argument into the ring here, supposing, from my perspective, it seems like that the park, if it chooses to keep the bike lane, is better able to serve people who live in Vancouver versus if they keep the vehicle traffic routes, then they're better able to serve people outside Vancouver.
Sorry, but you don't have some information. Perhaps it's understandable. There's a huge rental bicycle business. Shaw has many, many stations in various parts of Vancouver and also Stanley Park, where they have people check out rental bikes. So it's a huge tourist business. I might speculate that one particular company, Shaw, who has the rental bikes, might be fine with more bike lanes. But a lot of the bicyclists, a lot of the cyclists who see in Stanley Park in the summer, especially even in the winter, have those rental bikes, and they are very likely tourists from other places. So it is possible to, I believe, to have a progressive view of management of Stanley Park, a progressive view, and accommodate tourists by developing, let's say, the rental bike industry.
So, and I think that speaks to exactly where I wanted to go, Michael. And that's essentially what is the greater good here? The city of Vancouver should consider. Should they consider fundamentally the needs of the citizens of the city? Should they consider the needs of humanity in general for the city of Vancouver? It sounds strange to say it that way, but you know, tourists come from all over the place to see the city of Vancouver. And if they're no longer able to see Stanley Park as well as they were in the past, even if that's by a small amount, is that a disservice to everyone else or to tourists in general? So I think it's an interesting example that helps us consider the multifaceted approach there. I'm not familiar with all of the details of the history of the city of Vancouver. I do remember when I was in Seattle, I got some of the history of that city, and it was, to put it mildly, most of the history of the city of Seattle is due to corporate interests or people who have a lot of money deciding that, you know, this is the way things should be and that's the way they are, and making kind of upfront decisions. There were a lot of very interesting decisions in the history of the city of Seattle about how the city should be constructed that had some very negative outcomes. So to wrap up this show, I think we're not going to get any further. So we're not even finished with the Enlightenment. We are going to end on Hume, and we'll have to see where we go from there. To wrap things up, we've gotten into the beginning of the Enlightenment. We have looked at scientific progress, mathematical progress, technological progress, which seem to lead to or challenge the idea of social progress. The idea that once we've advanced the human mind, once it has been properly advanced, should be able to advance the condition of the society. This has been an interesting discussion, and I look forward to picking it up in the future. Thank you very much to my co-host, Michael Robert Kaditz. This has been Aaron Wang on The Canadian Philosophy Show. Thank you so much for listening.
Recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/the Canadian Philosophy Show and tcps.podbean.com.
This is CGSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio station at Simon Fraser University. We respectfully acknowledge that we broadcast on unceded ancestral territory of the Coast Salish peoples. We stream online at cjsf.ca. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and listen to our podcasts on SoundCloud and our website, cjsf.ca. Have a request? Text or call us at 778-782-2573.
Welcome to the ACC African Caribbean Connection with your host, Captain DJ Red Eyes, with the most right here at 90.1 FM CJSF. You can also check us out on www.cjsf.ca. African Caribbean Connection, each and every Saturday from 2 p.m. until 4 p.m. right here on your radio dial, 90.1 FM.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.